Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome to episode 309. This is a mini episode. It's an interview with two of my favorite filmmakers, Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato. And they've got a new film coming out on HBO the day after Christmas. And this is not a commercial endorsement. This is not a paid thing. I just really want people to see this film. And I also wanted to ask Randy and Fenton about their careers and a little bit about their personal lives. And I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. I'm here with Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato, who are producers who I mostly know for their work in documentaries. I'm a big fan. They have a new documentary out now on HBO that we're going to talk about, but I'd also like to talk about your career, why you're drawn to voices of people who, as you guys have said it in an interview, live out loud and have been marginalized by society. But most importantly, there is a documentary coming on December 26th to HBO called Every Brilliant Thing, starring Johnny Donahoe. Donahoe, am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yeah, Donahoe. Donahue is like... Donahue.
Okay.
Donahue?
Okay.
Donahue, Donahoe.
Donahoe?
Donatello.
It is a filmed performance of the stage play he's been doing off-Broadway for a while, and it is about depression, suicide, genetics, I suppose, and finding things to live for, things to get us through those times, embracing... This is my take on it. What is there to look forward to in the world? And he writes these things down, which is the what the title is based on. He starts a list of things he thinks are brilliant, and I was in tears 10 minutes into it when he was doing the thing about, and I don't cry, don't cry very much. Just when he was talking about his dog. It's one of the most moving documentaries I've ever seen, and it's so in the wheelhouse for my listeners that I was like, we have to do a mini episode and get these guys in here, even if so I can just meet them, because I'm such a fan. Tell the listener more about Every Brilliant Thing.
Well, you know, thanks so much. It's really nice to be here. And it's funny, as you were introducing it, we often talk about this film as based on a play about depression and suicide. And yet, really, I think the film and the play is ultimately very life-affirming. Mm-hmm. And In trying to create the poster, HBO came up with, a great line, which is a list for life. And this list for life that this kid starts writing when he's a kid to help his mother with her depression is something that I sort of feel I could do with one myself. You know, this idea that it's about the little things in life that make... It is the little things in life that make life living, the ordinary things, not necessarily the big milestones, but these, you know... And so even though, yes, it's about depression and suicide, it's really also about joy and wonder and exuberance, actually. And so, ironically, even though it's about such a dark subject, the film is kind of plays very funny.
Oh, definitely. He has a great sense of humor and very dry, very dark. And that's that brings comfort to not only to myself, but to people like our listeners who go through very, very dark times and need to know that they're not alone, need to be reminded that there is good in the world, that there is hope. You may not feel it at this moment, but, you know, think about that. The smell of the cottage that you went to as a kid and when bacon was cooking in the morning, you know, those little life rafts when you're feeling like you are never going to find an island. Give me a couple of... one of the things we do on the show is we do a list of fears and loves, and sometimes we just improvise them. But give me two each of kind of sublime things that you love.
Drag queens. I love drag queens.
And you guys produce RuPaul's Drag Race.
We do. Yeah.
You've known RuPaul since you were students?
Yeah. Yeah. Since my first couple of years in New York, and Brandy and I we'd left film school actually when we met Ru for the first time.
Yeah, shortly after leaving film school.
But you know, it was one of those moments that is just, you see someone and see something, and it's just instant, and you just recognize in that moment that there's someone who will change your life or who you identify as really significant. And I think for both of us, it was immediate recognition of this sort of, oh, you know, we've said before, oh, he was always a star and it was about waiting for the rest of the world to catch up. But I think in truth, to be more accurate about it, I think we just recognized this person who was incredibly powerful. And it wasn't so much the stardom, I think. I mean, Ru is an incredibly wise and centered person, and very has inspired certainly me, and I think both of us actually in our work and careers. So he's a figure who lives life out loud and is larger than life, but also very grounded and very very wise person.
So it would be fair to say that the spirit of people is kind of what you find compelling.
Yeah, and I think you can sometimes recognize that in someone before you even speak to them. I don't know how. I couldn't explain it to you, but it's just that sort of, you can just, something happens in a non-linguistic way, you just recognize that. You know?
Yeah. The energy force.
Yes. Yeah. What is it, if you can be a little more detailed about drag queens that you love? And you guys did not do Paris is Burning, did you?
We didn't, but we love Paris is Burning.
Oh my God.
It's like our Bible.
The first time I saw that, I'm cis, hetero, and I could not, first of all, I didn't understand how have I gone this far in my life and had no idea. You know, a theater student, liberal, lived in big cities, and I had no idea there was this whole subculture about drag queens
it's funny because we actually, you know, producing Drag Race, we actually make sure every season that the new contestants have seen Paris is Burning. It's like required. It just like Mommy Dearest is required viewing as well. But I think you know, and there is a connection weirdly between Every Brilliant Thing and Drag Queens, not just because Drag Queens would be on my list of brilliant things, but because, Drag queens, so many of them, they don't take life too seriously. They find the joy in life. They embrace the colors. And I do think that Johnny and the playwright, Duncan McMillan, I think that's part of what, you know, the inspiration they draw in Every Brilliant Thing. It is about finding hope in the colors of life. And you know, there is no, for people who are suffering depression, there's no one thing that, you know, can sort of, pull us from the depths of darkness and depression. But it is comforting to be reminded of the colors of life. It's comforting to kind of experience a connection with other people who not just suffer from depression but understand the darkness, and you know what I mean? So I think drag queens are, you know, shamanistic in that sense of they know the darkness, because they're, you know, it takes a lot to even be able to live that life, but they choose to recognize and embrace the lightness and the light. And so,
and I love that they take the very thing that is their hurdle in life and turn it into art, or a picket sign,
or a joke,
bullhorn, or you know, whatever it is that to me, I think is what touched me so much about Every Brilliant Thing, is he took this family, hereditary, I'm assuming it's hereditary in him, who knows, but it runs in his family, and even if he didn't suffer from it, just having a mother who was depressed and suicidal, how he took that and said, I'm going to find the beauty in life, instead of saying, I didn't get a childhood.
And the other thing about this play is the way they, you know, we made the TV adaptation of it. And part of our job as directors and documentarians was to sort of find a way to bring it to television without, and kind of honor its authenticity. I mean, it's an extraordinary theatrical experience.
It's the most intimate thing I've ever seen, because he does it in the round, and he involves members of the audience, and they're fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
It's unlike anything that I've seen before. And I was a little skeptical going in, because I'm like, oh, a Broadway thing about depression. You know, I think if you guys hadn't been attached to it, I don't know if I would have watched it, and I would have missed out on a really, really great piece of art.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it's funny you said, you know, what one of my great fears is audience participation. So it's like, you're going to go and see a play about depression and it's all audience participation. I was like, no, you know, I was like, I do not want to go see this. And immediately on entering, the fact that it's in the round was also a brilliant idea, because it's not that traditional divide between the stage and the audience. You're in the round. And Johnny is so amazing because he has some ability. He makes it look so easy.
He's a great improviser.
Right.
Because there has to be improvisation when you're picking out a different audience member each night.
Right. And is able to somehow set that whole room immediately at ease.
Absolutely.
So that feeling of like, oh, that terror, that fear of audience participation actually quickly gets set aside. And I don't think anyone in that room, when we taped it, had that fear that, understandably, I think many people have of, you know, now you're going to be singled out, and am I going to be good enough in that moment? It wasn't like that at all. It felt much like, a room full of like-minded people sharing something through Johnny and Duncan through his brilliant play about something that actually, even though we don't always talk about it, it's something that is universally relatable. Because you may not yourself suffer from depression, but chances are you know someone who does. Mm-hmm. And so it is a universal mm-hmm. experience. And yet, ironically, not something really, it seems that we go to great lengths to avoid talking yeah. about it.
And I think it's universal in that it's really about a hurdle. It's about something that makes you question the value of going on. You know, could be anxiety, could be trauma, could be, you know, a health issue. I almost feel like the fact that it was depression is just happens to be what this
right.
what this thing is about.
Uh-huh.
That's how I felt watching it.
Uh-huh.
And I live with depression. I've lived with depression for, you know, decades. But it's great. And how he managed to make it not feel like a performance, right. even though it was a performance. It's,
I think
it.
You could say it is a performance, but I think it's so authentic and so genuinely felt from the stages of writing to the way it's delivered. Mm-hmm. It isn't like it's real, mm-hmm. you know, it really is real.
I mean, we saw many performances before we filmed, and we actually, our film is a combination of three performances, each one equally magical. It was not like we needed to film three performances to get a good one. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, and not to give too much away, but it is audience participation, and some members play key roles. They're
the guy
like,
that played his father?
Yeah, they
You
play,
must have just been beside yourself in the editing room when you saw that footage.
We were, but I got to say, all three performances had three amazing men play his father. Mm. I mean, it's strange.
No, you be how, honest, the other two were shit.
No. We could do a remix. They were almost as good. No, they were there. I would say, it was a struggle to pick one, I guess is what I'm saying, because it's strange. He creates a sense of ease and comfort, and people rise to the occasion.
Yeah, a sense of safety, I think, is a safe space.
And if this is sounding a little unclear to listeners, what Johnny would do is he would say, you know, this thing happened to me when I was 7 years old. I was in the car with my father. Sir, would you mind playing my father? Pretend you're driving me to school and you're concerned that such and such. And so then he would improvise this little thing. And sometimes Johnny would make an adjustment and say, no, you know, maybe you're a little upset with me here. And it was, it's just a beautiful, unique.
And they are truly people off the street. You know, even the three performances we did, we didn't advertise. Literally there are people who walked in off the street. And, the interesting thing about this, someone plays his father, someone plays the girl he falls in love with. He casts it. He stands in the theater as people are coming in, and he just looks and scans the people who are coming in. Mm-hmm. And he decides just by watching people who he's going to pick as his father and who mm-hmm. he's going to pick as his girlfriend. It's
kind of, which, by the way, made it a challenge to shoot because it's in the round. And so these characters would be, for each different performance, sitting in a different place. Mm-hmm. There's no way of knowing where they were going to sit. You know, and we talked about, well, do we ask them to move and put them in certain seats? But it was like, no, you can't do that because you were then kind of interrupting the authenticity of this moment, and you're sort of interfering with it. And they were so right about that we just had to go with it. And worked out just great.
Yeah, we all the cameras were hidden. I mean, yeah.
You see a camera once or twice.
Yeah, right? But we really, like, our job was to not be there. Yeah. Like, that it was...
You did a good job because sometimes I'm looking for continuity or I want to see where the audience changes or I want to see where the camera is. And I really didn't see anything. I would like, if there's anything more that you'd like to talk about, Every Brilliant Thing, it debuts the day after Christmas on HBO. Do you not happen to know what time? I imagine in the evening?
9 o'clock.
East Coast?
East Coast, yes. 9 o'clock.
Okay.
I'm
sure people can find
check out. Check your local listings.
Check the internet. It's a series of tubes and wires. I would love to, you know, doing some research about you guys. Oh, the other documentary I wanted to say that I loved was Mapplethorpe, Look at the Pictures.
Oh, thank you.
You two met in the Village in the 80s, which obviously was the heyday of Robert right. Mapplethorpe.
Right.
Also, really kind of ground zero for AIDS.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't know what questions to ask you necessarily, but paint a picture for me of what it was like being in the Village as this bomb is exploding. And
well, that's a really, I mean, Randy and I met at film school, and it was certainly my first few days in New York. I'm from England originally. And I think what struck us was, I mean, we were very much in the East Village and didn't really go that much to the West Village. And it wasn't that there was a divide, but they were different worlds. And
would you meet under the viaduct like West Side Story?
Right. They were just slightly different generations, I suppose, yeah. Right? You know, yeah. West Village was like the big gay area, and East Village wasn't any less gay necessarily, but it was more sort of artists. It was this sort of, we were conscious of this artistic explosion. Like, you know, I remember meeting Martin Burgoyne, who was the designer who designed Madonna's record cover. He was always at the Pyramid in those ripped jeans. Mm-hmm. And there was John Sachs and Ethel Eichelberger and, in due course, Lady Bunny and RuPaul. There were all these amazing performers, and it was just this incredible, like, creative. I mean, I think at the time you didn't necessarily see it that way. You look back on it through slightly rose-tinted glasses, you know, but it was an incredible creative exposure of painters, not just performers, painters as well, right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, there were
Cannon Rains, the poet with the snake.
Yeah, there were all the 8BC and the Limbo Lounge. There were all these art spaces. And so the East Village was filled with, it was gender fluid. It was gender fuck. I don't know if we can say that.
Yeah, you can say
it was gender, okay, queer, gender queer. And it was so... So it was this time where anything was possible. But the West Village, it was also the time that it was the beginning of the AIDS crisis. And it started out as this thing that no, it was like a mystery.
Yeah. It was called gay cancer originally.
It was called gay cancer. And it seemed, you know, initially it seemed sort of far away, and it didn't seem, you know, nobody knew what it was about to become. And as it became that, it was kind of extraordinary. It was truly devastating, because it was this time in New York where it seemed like anything was possible, and artists were everywhere making stuff, and suddenly people were getting sick, and suddenly this other thing started to happen, and
often dying within days.
Yeah, absolutely. just sort of plucked out, almost like bad analogy, but like the Rhapsody, just people disappeared, mm-hmm. you know, very quickly.
And I'm sure you've seen the documentary on Fran Lebowitz when she talks about how you could see you know, you go to the ballet and be able to compare, oh, this year, here's what is not there because that person who had a part of this is no longer alive. And she said, you could see the art losing all these brilliant, imaginative people.
And it was also at a time where the actual physical landscape of New York City was changing. It was a time when it was sort of the beginning of the sort of gentrification. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, people were dying and people were slowly starting to be forced out because people could no longer, you know, the East Village was, you know, becoming less affordable. And so artists were, you know, being forced further downtown. And, you know, it just, it went from brightness to sadness and darkness.
Randy and I lived on 9th Street between B and C. And for many years, there was this massive, old, fantastic building, the Cristodora building, on the corner there of Avenue B and 9th Street. And it overlooked the park. And I can't remember what year it was, but after many years of being empty and abandoned and boarded up, it was renovated and sold off as luxury condominiums, prompting this gentrification riot in Tompkins Square Park. And so you could really see the whole neighborhood change from, it was a crack-infested neighborhood. You know, this was the time of the crack epidemic.
It was crack.
Sort of began to turn around into this sort of luxury condos and luxury apartments. And that was one of the great telling moments for, like, was meeting, going to Mapplethorpe's Loft, 45 Bond Street, that Joelle Sheffs had bought. God knows how much she paid, but it's like, you know, it's now worth $15 million. Mm-hmm. You know, just an insane amount of money.
Did you know Patty as well?
No.
Okay. But no. You knew Robert?
No.
Oh, okay.
We sort of... See, the thing is that we were there. We weren't a different generation, but we were younger.
He was famous, and we were significantly
younger and not famous. But we would be out and about, so we would be at the Michael Todd Room when some of his photographs were hanging on the wall.
So you were very aware of.
He was already famous, right?
Yes.
I mean,
outside the gay community.
Yes, I think he was a recognized, successful artist. I mean, this was pre the kind of scandal that defined him in many people's eyes, you know, which wasn't actually ironically until after his death. But he was still a name. It was the sort of same time as, like, it's so weird that Madonna and Mapplethorpe, you know, were very on sort of similar fame trajectories, right? Mm-hmm. And they both seemed to come from downtown. And
they were both brilliant at branding themselves.
Mm. Oh, my God. Yeah. Patti Smith, she's the Patty I'm referring to listeners, lived with Robert for a long time. And her book, she talks about how relentlessly he promoted himself and how just single-minded he was.
Yeah.
And I loved your documentary about him. What are some other documentaries that people might know you guys from? I was talking to Randy before we started recording and saying that probably my favorite one that you guys did is 101 Rent Boys. That was where I first became aware of you guys, because when the credits rolled, I was just like, who did this? Who showed me this world? And it's about, you describe it.
Well, it's a film where we interviewed 101 rent boys or sex workers. And it was, we made it before, it was like pre Grindr or pre online hooking up. So, you know, it was back in the time when people actually walked the streets.
You had to get in your car and drive to get your dick sucked.
Yes.
Back when we were kids.
Back when, yeah. And back then, the place to do that was around Santa Monica Boulevard. And that was, that whole project came about because it was around the time when Fenton and I moved to Los Angeles, and we were trying to get projects made. And we would, our office was right around the corner from Santa Monica Boulevard. And whenever we would go to kind of pitch an idea to someone, we would drive along Santa Monica Boulevard to the west side. And we would see these guys, and we would joke about, like, you know, we're doing the exact same thing. You know, they're doing their thing out on the street, and we're going to a meeting to pitch our ideas. And then that's when we sort of cooked the idea of, like, wow, we should talk to them, and we should make a sort of up with prostitutes film. Like, that was the original intention. The original intention was, we have so much in common with these guys. Nobody ever actually has conversations with them in a non-judgmental way, and in a way where people can connect with them and their humanity. It didn't totally turn out that way, because I guess what we didn't really anticipate was just, you know, there was just so much sadness and so much darkness.
That's what I loved about it, though, is you didn't shy away from it.
No.
You didn't try to put a bow on it.
Yeah.
And it just was so, well, to me, felt authentic.
And it really was. I mean, the reality is what guided what we ended up making. I guess I just wish some of the stories weren't as, you know, as dire or sad. And there were so many great people we met, some of whom we still know.
Mm-hmm. But there was also humor in it. There was some lightness in it. But yeah, there was a lot of,
yes,
a lot of sadness and I don't even know what the word
is. And we filmed all the interviews, because there were all these hotels along Santa Monica Boulevard.
Yeah.
So we would film the interviews in hotel rooms in the along Santa Monica Boulevard. Another sort of surprising and interesting thing about this is, we were making another film at the exact same time, which is a film called The Eyes of Tammy Faye, which is about Tammy Faye.
Another great documentary.
Mesner. Mm-hmm. And so during the day, we would be filming with Tammy Faye, and then at night, we'd be filming with these streetwalkers.
I mean, there was a sort of, funnily enough, because one of our ideas that was the title, 101, I think 101 Dalmatians was out at the time. So that's sort of where the title came from. And then we were like, well, you know, the golden rule in documentaries is you don't pay people. And we were like, they should be paid. It's their story. We should pay them for their stories. We don't want to have sex with them, but let's pay them for their stories. And so many of their stories, and Randy's right, there's a tremendous amount of heartache and tragedy in a lot of them. But at the same time, they were so insightful about people. They really understood people. They had a wisdom beyond many shrinks and psychiatrists and so-called professionals. They just knew about people and what makes people tick and what their needs are. And often it wasn't sex. It was often companionship and people just carrying around. Just people
wanting to be heard and seen.
Yeah, or held. Just people feeling so lonely. And so, ironically, there was something quite spiritual about it.
Yes.
Which, making a film about Tammy Faye, she was a very spiritual person, but these hustlers were also kind of really spiritual people in the way they sort of administered, you know?
Another thing I would like to ask you about is, you did a documentary about Monica Lewinsky, and I don't know if it was you guys that referred to her as kind of the original person being piled on slightly before the internet, I guess, right?
Yeah.
I think Monica's like
She's
said kind of, as much in her TED talk, right? That she was the original...
The ground zero for public shaming.
Right.
Mm-hmm. She sort of... She authored that. She has described herself as that. Mm-hmm. And certainly when we made our film with her, which was for HBO, Monica in Black and White, it was... She still wasn't in a place where she could... talk about what happened to her. Like, it's really been in the past 3 years. It was a TED talk she did a few years ago that she really has fully kind of embraced, not embraced what's happened to her, but just has understood it and been able to walk with her head held high and to talk about it in a really open and smart way. When we made our film, I mean, she could talk about what happened, but it was still so raw.
Well, and also people wouldn't let her own the experience, or wouldn't let her. They were so, and people are still very polarized about it and have their judgments, but they wouldn't let her redefine herself or explain herself. And she really just wanted to be heard, and people wouldn't listen. I remember one of the most painful experiences was at the Television Critics Association, where HBO presented the film with Monica, and they also were presenting right after it the In Memoriam, the 9/11 film with Rudolph Giuliani. And it was such a hostile room of critics and journalists. And one person actually asked, and she wrote a brilliant Vanity Fair piece around the time of her TED talk, and she begins the Vanity Fair piece by referencing this very moment where one journalist says, "Why don't you crawl away and die?" That was a question from the audience.
People just know the sensational headlines about that story. Like, you know, the details get lost. Mm-hmm. And so she's made mistakes, and she owns those. But there's a lot more to the story than just the sensational headlines of it.
Okay. I want to go back to the loves. So you... love drag queens. Fenton, you've had a good 25 minutes to think about yours.
Well, I don't know.
And the more detailed, the better.
Yeah.
It's all in the details.
Well, I mean, just trying to pay. I love Saturday afternoons. Like, well, you could say that's not very specific, but there's no question in my mind that some of my happiest times have been on a Saturday afternoon. It's that sort of few hours when nothing is really expected of you, when you can just enjoy the moment. And I just have this very strong memory of coming home from boarding school when I was a kid, and it was a Saturday, and my mother said, "Oh, let's go to the sweet shop." And we walked along the road to the village, and I can't remember if you have them here, but they're like these hard candies that are like, they have a sort of pear type, they're like pear drops. Anyway, I just remember walking along the river, eating these pear drops, and I can remember it so clearly. And it's not like anything said anyone to anything. It was just this moment, but it was this sort of magical moment that I just remember with great fondness. Mm. And it just seems to sort of cast a sort of has a halo effect on every Saturday afternoon since.
We have a variety of surveys that listeners fill out. You know, ones where they share their deepest secrets, things that turn them on, traumas that have happened to them, things they love, sublime moments in their life that have touched them. And of the thousands I've read, I've never read a happy moment where it was somebody getting something materialistic. It was always the day my dad took me out of school and we went fishing, or... it's all about these things where they just were present with another person or at peace with themselves and nature.
Right. It's not necessarily that anything necessarily happens. It's not necessarily anyone needs to say something to anyone. It's just this sort of, exactly. It's just this moment.
Yeah. Anything else that you guys would like to talk about, share, promote?
I don't think that there's a lot of mainstream media attention or programming that deals with depression or things that block people from moving forward. I don't, you know, it's like Fenton said earlier, like people would rather avoid either talking about it or, you know, making a whole program about it. So we feel really blessed that HBO was kind of enthusiastic, not only about making Every Brilliant Thing, but are putting it on and putting it on during the holidays, which is kind of genius because,
oh my God,
you know, like it's the perfect time. And then the fact that this is actually kind of uplifting. And so I really hope people get to see it and they get to share it with other people because, you know, not just it's a great show for people, not only who experience depression, but I think it's as important to people who don't.
Yeah. Agreed. You know? Agreed. Yeah. There's a saying we have on the podcast, thinking you understand clinical depression because you've experienced situational sadness is like thinking you understand Italy because you've been to the Olive Garden.
That's brilliant. That's a brilliant thing. Oh, that's yeah, great. Yes.
There's a lot of people don't understand the difference that, between the two. Mm-hmm. And I think the Johnny's thing really should be seen by everybody. Fenton, Randy, so great to meet you and talk to you. And I look forward to future things you have have coming out. And for the listeners, Every Brilliant Thing, HBO, the day after Christmas. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. Like I said, this is just a mini episode, so a regular episode will be up as usual on Friday. And we'll see you then. Thanks for listening.